Hello and welcome to City Bible Forum. It's great to see you here again. We'll get underway in a moment, but I'll draw your attention to there's a communication card on the side of your handout. So if you want to jot down any questions, we don't have time for them at the end, or if you're interested in hearing regular updates about your activities at City Bible Forum, then please just fill that in and leave it in the box on your way out. We've reached the third week of our Show Me a Sign series. This week we're looking at where Jesus fed 5,000 men, maybe as many as 20,000 people, with one cup lunch. The passage is there on page 2 of your handout, so please open them up and we'll get underway. Some time after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is, the Sea of Tiberias. And a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the miraculous signs he had performed on the sea. Then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover feast was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, "8 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up, "Here's a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go among so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. When they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. Woody Allen once said, "I wish God would give me a sign. A large deposit in my name in a Swiss bank account would suffice." That kind of sign would be a nice sign to get, wouldn't it? And often our desire for signs is the desire for things which actually suit us. Sometimes it's the sign that we want itself. My wife and I have recently bought a house, and it was the end point of 6 months of looking around. My wife and Narelle spent about 6 months researching, working very hard. And when we first saw the place that we've now bought, I walked out into the backyard, and there was this huge jacaranda tree there. And I'm a big fan of jacarandas. They're my favourite tree. In fact, my wife would say that I've got something of an obsession with jacarandas. I introduced her to my favourite jacaranda tree in Sydney a few years ago and made her walk in to see it from 5 different angles. So when I saw this jacaranda tree, I smiled to myself and thought, is this God's sense of humour? Is this a sign that he wants us to buy this house? How do we work out whether we're seeing a sign? How do we work out whether this is a sign from God or whether it's just something that we want? I know a few people who have got married on the basis of signs. They've met someone, there's been so many coincidences, so many things that they have in common with this person that they've taken it that this must be a sign from God. It's only years later when things have got hard or things haven't worked out that they've asked the question, was that really a sign or was that just me projecting what I wanted? How do we see signs? How do we know whether it's really a sign or whether it's just what we want? Say, for example, I was driving to an appointment. I'm running late. And so I say to myself, I say to God, I really need to be here on time. And if you give me a sign, then I'll slow down. But apart from that, I'm going to speed to get there. And you turn the corner and you drive past the big sign saying 50 kilometers per hour. And so you say to God, okay, well, if you give me a sign that's out of the ordinary, then I'll slow down. And a fox runs down in front of your car. And so you say to yourself, now God, if you send a kangaroo, sometimes we can actually use signs as an excuse to not do something that we don't want to do. Or sometimes we can use signs as, well, it's actually the sign itself that we're after. Imagine I was facing an exam tomorrow, and I thought to myself, well, I haven't studied for this, and I guess I do deserve to fail. But God, if you help me to pass, if I pass this exam, then I will know that you're real. Is it that we want to know that God is real, or is it that we want the sign itself? The problem is that we always have mixed motives. We all have mixed motives. And we bring these mixed motives to our desire for the sign. The people who saw Jesus' signs were in the same boat. These signs that Jesus did were pointed to things about him, or who he was, or the things that he could do. And last, the first of our signs that we saw was Jesus turning water into wine. And then the next week we saw that Jesus went to the temple and he cleared out all the people who were earning money there. He cleared all the merchants out of the temple. And the week after, we saw last week that Jesus healed a man who'd been paralyzed for 38 years. And people started to follow him as a result. But they brought their mixed motives with them. And we see them very clearly in the passage. Just take another look at lines 2 to 4. And a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the miraculous signs he had performed on the sick. These people were following Jesus not because they understood who he was, not because they understood what he was going to do, but because they felt need with sickness. They were sick. They knew people who were sick. And so they brought those mixed motives to Jesus. Now, we're all going to have mixed motives. That's unavoidable. But when it becomes a problem is when we're unwilling to look where the sign, where God points us, because that's not what we're after. We see that that happened to this crowd at the end of this passage. Look down at line 29. Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. One of the mixed motives that the people brought to Jesus and saw his signs from was that they wanted freedom. They weren't a country like Australia who elected their own prime minister. They were ruled over by the Romans. First century Jewish Palestinians who lived in Palestine were ruled by, they were just a colony, it's a superpower of the day. And what they wanted, perhaps most of all, was freedom. Freedom to follow their God as they wanted. Freedom to exercise their choice. And they saw in Jesus a man who could do that. This man was able to feed thousands of people. If they could just start a rebellion now, if they could catch Jesus up in that rebellion, then Jesus would have no choice. He'd have to run with it. If they could make him the leader of a rebellion, then the circumstances would take over. What they did was they came to Jesus with mixed motives, and it became a problem when Jesus pointed them to a place other than where they wanted to go. Well, the next day after this happened, the crowd manages to find Jesus, and they come to him, and he points out another mixed motive of them. Jesus answered, "I tell you the truth, you're looking for me, not because you saw miraculous signs, but because you ate the loaves and had your fill." They had a very powerful motivation that they brought to Jesus, a desire for food. People today, people back then, brought mixed motives to Jesus. 14 years ago, I had a Copernican revolution in my life. I don't know if you've heard, I'm sure you've heard of Copernicus. He was the guy who said that the sun was at the center and the earth revolves around the sun. Everyone else was thinking that the earth was in the centre and the sun was revolving around it. And I had a Copernican revolution 14 years ago. My realisation was that I am not the centre of the universe. You guys already know that, because you're the centre of the universe, aren't you? My realisation 14 years ago was that God is the centre of his universe. I'm not the centre of his universe. And the same is true with these signs. God is the reason for these signs. God is at the centre of these signs. These signs aren't given for our sake. They're given to make a point about God. Often we have our signs, we're looking for signs because we want to know what decision does God want me to make? What does God want me to do? And when God starts talking about himself, we're disappointed. With this sign, God was talking about himself. Well, let's take a closer look at this sign. Line 18 tells us a little bit more about it. There's a crowd that's gathered that numbered 5,000 men, with the addition of women and children, probably more like 20,000. This crowd had followed Jesus. They'd actually followed him across a lake, the Sea of Galilee. These days, the other side of the lake is the Golan Heights. And so Jesus and his disciples had withdrawn to this place to get a bit of rest, to withdraw from the crowd. So the crowd followed them around the north side of the lake and tracked them down. And so Jesus, seeing them, says to one of his followers, "Where are we going to get food to feed all of them? There's no corner shop. This is a withdrawn, lonely place. Where are we going to get food?" And Philip says, 8 months' wages. Wouldn't even buy a bite for each of them. All I can find is 5 small loaves, probably, you know, the size of a friand or a muffin, little cakes of bread, and 2 small fish. Jesus takes the food and gives thanks to God for it and then distributes it amongst the 5,000 people. Line 20 tells us that people had as much as they wanted. In line 22, they all had enough to eat. They were sitting down on the grass after this meal, loosening their belts because they were stuffed. They had their fill. In fact, there was more leftovers than there was food at the beginning of this banquet. Line 24, they collected up 12 basketfuls of bread. What happened? There's 2 explanations that have been offered. The first is that people ate sparingly. This was a lesson in sharing. They all took the bread and had a little nibble and passed it on to the next person. 20,000 nibbles later, there was still some food left over. Well, that would have had to been a pretty small nibble, and I doubt that the people would have been left feeling satisfied at the end. A more plausible explanation is that the people were shamed into sharing their food. They saw this little boy who shared his only food with this big crowd, and they went, "Oh, right, if he's willing to share his stuff, then here's my secret stash. I did bring some Pringles along." And so they all share their food, and from that food, there's 12 basketfuls left over. Well, John was there, and line 24, he tells us, "So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten." He said that the leftovers hadn't come from people's secret stashes. They'd come from these original 5 barley loaves. John thought that something miraculous had happened. And there were 20,000 people who agreed with him, because the next day people come to Jesus not saying, "Okay, we've brought out another secret stash to share with you." They come to Jesus saying, "We want another meal." The people who were there thought that this was a miracle. Now, we as modern people have some objections to miracles. We touched on this last week. If you want to read a little bit more about miracles and whether it's logical to believe in them, then there's some more information on the way out. You can grab a handout about that. But the people who were there on this day thought that Jesus had done something supernatural. So the question is, what does it mean? If this line is a pointer, what does it show us? Well, a hint here in our passage. The hint is when Jesus did this. Line 6, the Jewish Passover feast was near. 3 times in John's book, Jesus deliberately does something on the Passover. He chooses to act on this day to make a point. The first time was when he, it was a couple of chapters ago. It was one of the previous times that we had. The first time was when he had gone to the temple and cleared out all the merchants there. He said, his disciples remembered that God had written, "Zeal for your house will consume you." Jesus was going to get gobbled up. He was going to get destroyed physically because of what he did on that day, on that first Passover. This is now the next Passover, and Jesus on this day does something with food. He feeds people with a special symbol. The next time in John we come to the Passover, Jesus is shedding his blood. Now, the Passover was a really important feast for the Jews. It was probably their most important feast. It remembered a time 1400 years earlier when God had freed people from slavery in Egypt. They'd been slaves there, and God had sent a messenger, a guy called Moses, to the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, and said, "Let my people go." Pharaoh had said no, and so God sent some signs. He sent blood and hail and locusts and flies. He sent plagues, and the final plague that he sent was the plague of death. Death passed through the land one night, and every firstborn in Egypt died. Every firstborn, that is, except for the Jewish firstborn. Because what they had done is they had killed a lamb and painted the blood from this lamb, on the doorposts, on the door frames of their houses. And when the plague of death had passed through Egypt, the houses that had the blood, the message had been, no death here tonight, something has already died. Jesus compared himself with that lamb. He said, "I'm that lamb who will die so that other people won't." The other metaphor that he used on this Passover was bread. Jesus declared, "I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry, and he who believes in me will never be thirsty." Jesus is using a picture. He's saying, "Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day." Jesus is using a picture. He's saying, just like that lamb shed its blood so that the firstborn, the Jewish firstborn, didn't die, you can eat my flesh, you can drink my blood, so that your life will be sustained. He said that I'm like bread. You need me like breakfast. You're not going to make it through the day. You're not going to, your life won't be sustained without my life. Well, how do you think the crowd took this? How do you think the crowd that had come with mixed motives responded to Jesus when he started talking about himself and comparing himself with bread? Well, not very well. We see that they came with mixed motives, and that in the end, these mixed motives shine through. On hearing it, many of his disciples said, "This is a hard teaching. Who can accept it?" From this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. They were following Jesus across to the other side of Lake Galilee because he was healing people. They came to him the next day and tracked him down back on the Israelite side because he fed people. Their motives weren't bad in themselves. But when Jesus started talking about something else, then they refused to have their gaze diverted to something, to another object. We all have mixed motives. We all bring our mixed motives to our request for a sign. Don't let your mixed motives make you miss the point. Because things might not go according to plan. You might ask God for a sign of a successful relationship or profitability in your business. You might bring to him certain requests, but you also bring in mixed motives. And if what those signs point you to is all you're left with, you might be left with a bitter taste in your mouth. Back in 1996, three young men had a few beers and then decided to steal some traffic signs. They stole a bunch of them and took them home and put them up on their walls. And I'm sure they looked good on their walls. A jury later found that on that night they pulled up a stop sign and left it by an intersection. A few days later, some teenagers ran through that intersection and were killed. Those signs might have looked good on their walls, but they were pointing to something more important. The signs that God has given are pointing to something more important. They're pointing to something about Jesus, about what he's able to do. If we come with a desire for a sign, then that's not a bad thing. But if we get disappointed that God doesn't give us a sign in our life, in our circumstances, right now, today, if we get dissatisfied that God only gave us a sign 2,000 years ago, then what we've done is we've come with our mixed motives. We've got caught up in the sign and refused to look where the sign points us. Well, not everyone was disappointed. There was a few, 12, who Jesus asked, "You don't want to leave me too, do you?" He asked the 12. Simon Peter replied, Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life." Peter got it. He understood that eternal life is bigger than food. Food can keep you sustained for a day. He understood that Jesus was offering to sustain people forever. If I ask God for a sign, I ask him for a winning lottery ticket. And I said, "If you help me win this $1 million, then I'll know that you're real." What would be the bigger thing? The $1 million or the God that gave it? We can get so caught up in the signs that we miss their point. What God has in mind for us, what he shows us when he starts talking about himself, is much bigger than anything we could ask for. It's much bigger than even signs that we could imagine. What God offers us is eternal life. He offers us a relationship with the God who's made us. He's offered us a life that can be sustained forever. That life comes through Jesus, who offered his life as a sacrifice so that death would pass over God's people. God's got something on bigger on offer than a jacaranda tree or a good marriage. God's got something on offer which will last forever. Don't miss out on it because you've brought mixed motives to your desire for a sign. We've got a couple of minutes now. We've got a few minutes, actually, for any questions that you might have. Welcome to guests that we had come in. But if you've got any questions, then now is the opportunity. The guests that have come in because there's an activity that's coming up in a couple of weeks' time. You know that Easter is in early April this year, so at the end of March, we're going to have a special campaign here in the city asking the question, sex, God, politics, why is God free? If we're free to talk about these important topics like sex and politics, then why don't people talk about God as well? And we're hoping that it'll be an opportunity for people who work in the city to come and think through this important topic. The people who have joined us will be special guests for that week as well, helping to share the message of Easter, to help people to step beyond the Easter egg. We heard this week that we've got some advertising in the West Australian, and there'll be a mobile billboard that you'll see driving around the city. Hopefully you'll put this question on the agenda of why is God to do? Why are we unwilling to speak about him? We'll have three events during the week. First is going to be a debate on the question, or on the statement really, people should keep their religion to themselves. You'll be glad to hear that it's the atheist who's going to be arguing the affirmative, and the Christian will be arguing the negative. So this is too important a topic for us to keep to ourselves. The other common objection to talking about God is that religion just leads to violence. And so on Wednesday here, we'll have a forum with question and answer time, and on the Thursday, we'll have another forum right here before heading in the next week into a course. Look through one of Jesus' policies. So more information will come up on this website, but if you are able to hang around and meet some of the guests who will be with us that week, then it's an opportunity to do that now. If you want to fill in those comment cards, it's a chance to ask any questions or give us your contact details so we can keep in touch with what's coming up. See you next week for the fifth sign in our series, and it should be a good one.
Thank you. I mean, I can understand why, but I don't. Okay, there's a meeting room just around the corner. You can probably even go through that door. Meeting room 2, we'll squeeze in there.